Hey, Leading Learning listener, if you represent a membership organization looking for ways to expand your online course catalog rapidly with high-quality content, we have good news.
At leadinglearning.com/AMA, you can find out how to make online training from the American Management Association available to your learners.
Through a partnership between AMA and Tagoras, the parent company of Leading Learning, you can give your learners access to more than 70 e-learning modules covering essential business topics ranging from leading and innovating to managing projects effectively to working in hybrid teams.
For details on how to grow your catalog with courses from a true global leader in management training, visit leadinglearning.com/AMA. Reading, particularly reading guided by active inquiry and genuine curiosity, is a great way to learn. What do you plan to read? I'm Salisa Steele.
I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast. It's June as we're recording, which means the start of summer. At least it means that where we are in North Carolina in North America.
The start of summer brings the end of school, and the end of school means many weeks without school for most K through 12 students in the United States, although there are more year-round schools now, including some in our area.
That's true, and part of the reason that there may be more year-round schools is because of summer learning loss. And summer learning loss is the loss of academic skills and knowledge over the course of summer vacation in countries like the United States that have these lengthy breaks.
As you might imagine, summer learning loss can get quite political, but for the sake of our conversation today, we simply want to make the point that for some students, SLL, yep, there is an acronym for that, SLL is real, and it varies. According to a national study whose results were published in the summer of 2020, more than half of students suffered a learning loss over five consecutive summers, and kids in that group lost an average of 39% of the gains they had made over the school year. That's a 39% loss over summer on average. But if you look at the numbers that make up that average, you see a different story. Some kids lose as much as 90%. Yikes, of what they learn in a school year over the summer. But other kids don't slide back over the summer, and they don't even just hold steady. In fact, they improve up to 32% of their in-school gains over the summer.
Now, of course, our focus at Leading Learning in general and on the Leading Learning podcast is adult lifelong learners, not K through 12 students. But what's interesting in that data that you shared, Salisa, is that the same span of time, those weeks of summer vacation, can be a learning loss for some and can be a learning gain for others, which leads to the question of what individuals can do to make sure that we wind up with gains, not losses.
The short answer is to do something that expands what you know, and reading is a great way to do that.
Which is why we're focusing this episode on our 2023 beach reads.
Well, I'm not sure these are going to actually count as beach reads, but we will at least each share three books, and we're going to plan to crack their covers this summer, and we'll share a little bit about why we picked these books and what we hope to learn from them.
Yeah, I think it's sort of doubtful that I'm going to be reading these on the beach, but who knows? We'll see. But definitely summer. And we'll each share a book of fiction, a book of nonfiction, and then a wild card.
So let's dig in and let's start with nonfiction, and I can kick things off for us. I plan to read Beyond Disruption, Innovate and Achieve Growth Without Displacing Industries, Companies, or Jobs. And that's by W. Chan Kim and Renee Moborn. And I am really excited about this book. In fact, I think we've already made at least one reference to it in a podcast out earlier this year. But this is a new book by folks whose work we know, whose work we admire, whose work we use. We are big fans of their book, Blue Ocean Strategy. And I'm really interested and in fact, compelled by the pitch of this new book. The concept is that innovation and disruption so often go hand in hand, but they make the argument that innovation doesn't have to be disruptive. Innovation doesn't have to put people out of jobs or organizations out of business. And I really like this idea that innovation can be creative rather than destructive. And I get the sense that part of what they're doing is making an argument for the double bottom line, you know, i.e. innovation that's good for the business that's innovating, but also good for society.
Yeah, and I think this will probably be a theme throughout this episode, but this is also one I will most likely be reading as well for many of the same reasons. Also a big fan of Kim and Mo Burn and their Blue Ocean strategy work. I think this feels to me like a response to, I guess, the sort of classic creative destruction idea from economics, people like Joseph Schumpeter, and then also in the innovation world, people like Clayton Christensen. So I'm eager to see what they do with this.
Right. So I'm interested in that just sort of general concept. But in terms of what I hope to learn is I also hope to get some practical ways to think about what they are calling non-disruptive creation. And I'm thinking that those ideas then maybe, you know, may apply to our own work here at Tagoras and Leading Learning, and may also help us working with organizations that we help through consulting and other services as well.
All right. So what I think is probably soon to be yet another classic from Kim and Mo Burn in the business world. I'm sort of in the business world. I'm definitely in the business world myself with my nonfiction work here. But it gets into kind of culture, communication, a little bit philosophical as well. So what I am going to read in the nonfiction area is actually, well, I'm cheating a little bit because it's a reread. Mm-hmm. And I will say I'm a big fan of rereading. I think I've heard people like Stephen King, the famous author, say he will never read a book twice, that, you know, once you've read it, you move on. I don't agree with that at all. Even for fiction, I will reread. But I think, you know, if you want to learn, it's great to go back to a book because, of course, you're going to forget. No matter, you know, how good you are about taking notes and everything else, you're going to forget a ton of what you've read. In fact, I find that I often forget pretty much 100% of what I've read. But even if you do,
Ebbinghaus, right there. Right?
There you go. Yeah, my 90% happens like that. Even if you do remember what you've read before, anytime you go back to a book, to a movie, to whatever, you're just in a different place. And so it's going to mean something different to you, and you're going to learn something different in the process. So I'm
that's a long lead up to whatever you're going to tell us.
I'm sure everybody's really curious about what this is. The book that I have in mind is Humble Inquiry, The Gentle Art of Asking Instead of Telling. And this is a book from Edgar Schein. And Edgar Schein was a professor at MIT in business. I said this was coming out of business. I'm not sure if he was actually in the business department, but he's associated with organizational behavior, organizational development, culture. He did a lot of work in that throughout a, you know, very long, distinguished career. And he passed away earlier this year in January. And I'd been aware of his work for a long time and had read Humble Inquiry. I want to dig into more of his work than I have, because I mean, he was a major figure in organizational behavior and culture. He's one of those types of business thinkers that I just don't feel like you get as much of anymore. Particularly, I mentioned Clayton Christensen earlier. I think he was a little bit in this vein, and he passed away recently as well. But these are people who I put in kind of the same camp as like a Peter Drucker, who I think is the towering figure of the sort of business philosopher. And so, you know, I want to read this again, partly and to honor him. And I, you know, feel like he's got a great body of work that I want to explore. But, you know, I also feel like we're in this period in our own culture where there's just an awful lot of telling going on. You know, when you think about social media, you think about the rise of the influencer out there, just a lot of people expressing their opinions, telling other people what to do, which of course has always been the case, but we have a megaphone like we've never had before in doing that sort of thing. And so this idea of just being good at asking, at being good at listening, and of bringing that element of humility to the process. I've written here and there about humility. In fact, I think in our last newsletter, I raised humility as an aspect of leadership. And I think it's just, you know, people will use that term, but I think it's greatly mm-hmm. underappreciated and undervalued. And what I do remember of this book, and I'll say it's a short one, so, you know, anybody who doesn't feel like they can tackle anything huge this summer, I think I've got it right here, and I can see it's, you know, it's barely over 100 pages. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely within anybody's capabilities to get through. And I remember it being a good read and just a very helpful read. And so I'm hoping to kind of, you know, reinvigorate my own ability to ask well and to ask humbly.
I think that idea of humility and being humble, being a humble leader is interesting. And then it seems like there's a bit of a tactical aspect here, which is one way to go about being humble is through asking and making sure that you're doing that effectively. So it sounds very interesting. I think I might, as you said, probably put yours on my list, just as you're putting mine on your list.
That's the way it always happens with these with these book lists. But yeah, hopefully by the end of the summer, I will have learned to be a better asker, a more humble asker. And I'd say too that, you know, this whole, you know, asking with humility really is about learning. I mean, mm-hmm. you're listening. You really are taking in what somebody else is telling you, sharing with you. That's just so fundamental to being a good learner. So hopefully I will be learning to be a better learner as I reread Edgar Schein's Humble Inquiry.
Well, even just what you shared there, not having read Schein's work yet, but it does seem aligned with potentially beginner's mind in this idea of, you know, coming to a subject as a learner with sort of no expectations and just being willing to learn can be very powerful. You said you sort of cheated by going back to a reread, but one of the things that can be so overwhelming is that there are so many things to read, so many books and options out there. And so for me, I do always like to look at authors and thinkers whose work I already know. And so then you have somebody like, you know, Kim and Mo Bourne that have a new book out. And so I'm going to go check that out. Or even rereading in this camp, you know, what is it that you've actually already found useful? And then, as you said, you're bringing different experience, different point of view, because you're rereading it in a different time. So going back to those, I do know that there are some writers, you know, Kim and Mo Bourne are among them, but I think there are others like Dan Pink, you know, who could pretty much write about anything, and I would pick it up and be curious just because I know that they approach it in a deliberate, thoughtful, and typically sort of a slightly off point of view, I might say. You know, they bring a little bit of a different perspective than you're going to get from anyone else.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I have reread Pink. I have reread Kim and Mo Bourne. And like you, if something is coming out from them, I will look for it. Another one for me is Yuval Noah Harari, who I hope I'm not butchering his name, but the author of Sapiens and Homo Deus, and just very, very interesting thinker. In fact, I reread Sapiens last summer and was just struck again by what an amazing book it is. So folks are getting lots of suggestions from us besides the ones that we're actually
We're really
offering.
Only offering three each. That's right.
As someone who listens to the Leading Learning podcast, you should know about the Leading Learning newsletter, which you can subscribe to at leadinglearning.com/inbox. The newsletter is inbox intelligence for learning businesses and helps you understand the latest technology, marketing, and learning trends and grow your learning business. Best of all, it's a free resource. As a subscriber, you'll get Leading Links, our monthly curated collection of resources to help you grow the reach, revenue, and impact of your learning business. The Podcast Digest, a monthly summary of podcast episodes released during the previous month, plus periodic announcements highlighting Leading Learning webinars and other educational opportunities designed to benefit learning business professionals. Subscribe for free at leadinglearning.com/inbox. And if you're already subscribed, point a colleague to leadinglearning.com/inbox. So we've covered nonfiction. Now let's look at what we're going to read fiction-wise. And I think I've said it before on the podcast at some point. I know I've written it at points that in spite of my having come out of a background in literature, I mean, before this whole, you know, learning business world we're in, I was on the path to be a literature professor. So I read a lot of fiction, but I've gotten to a point in my life where I think I don't sort of automatically appreciate fiction the way I used to. And I'll go for months at a time without reading a work of fiction. And when I finally come back and read a good one, I'm immediately like, oh yeah, I understand why it is so important to read fiction, not just to go for the facts and the history and everything else. Fiction is just such a rich experience that that can teach you so much. And I forget that, and I should not forget that. I need to remember it constantly. And hopefully we will help our listeners remember that during this episode.
So what fiction are you going to recommend to our listeners today?
Well, this is an area where I'm also a fan of rereading, but I'm going to go for something new on this one. And one I happen to stumble across, it just struck me. And I thought I've got to give this a try, is a book called The Guest Lecture by Martin Riker. And I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that last name correct. It's R-I-K-E-R, which I believe it is Riker. And, you know, I think I first stumbled across this because somebody had a little blurb about it in something like Inside Higher Education, but then I've also seen it talked about in the New York Times. And as you might guess, it's about an academic. And my understanding is the sort of general setup is a woman who's an economist who has been denied tenure at the university she's at, unfortunately, a common academic situation. In the aftermath of that, she has to deliver, she's already been booked to deliver this lecture on optimism and John Maynard Keynes. John Maynard Keynes, you know, economists have come up already in this episode, towering economist, you know, one of the big ones from the early half of the 20th century, whose influence we still feel greatly. So she's supposed to be talking about him, and she's apparently lying in bed in a hotel room with her husband and child there with her, who've come along with her. She's awake in the middle of the night and doesn't feel prepared at all to give this lecture. She's been dealing with the aftermath of not getting tenure and, you know, having to support a family and all that sort of stuff. And she's trying to memorize the speech, the points of her speech. She's actually using the method of loci, which I've written about before, as a memorization method, and is sort of engaging with Keynes as she's like imagining the speech. And it just sounded like a really interesting sort of thought experiment and setup, and being somebody who's often awake in the middle of the night and thinking about things, it probably just resonated with me. And I think it's interesting to read the reviews on it, because it's one of those books that there are people who give it like, you know, 1 and 2 stars because they just hate this kind of thing, this sort of setup, and there are people who give it 5 stars and it's brilliant. And I suspect I'm probably going to be more in the 5-star range, but we'll see.
I do remember reading about that book as well. So again, I will probably want to steal it from you when you're done with it. In terms of the fiction that I'm going to suggest, I'm going to go to a classic. It's a classic that I've never read, though. It's David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. I've read other Dickens, but I'm interested in this Dickens and this Dickens now because I just finished Barbara Kingsolver's Demon Copperhead, and that was a co-winner of the 2023 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. And Barbara Kingsolver, I've read her other work, so she sort of falls in that Pink and Kim and Mulborn camp where, you know, if she puts something out there, I want to read it. But she used David Copperfield as sort of the framework for her book, Demon Copperhead, and sort of recast the story, modernized it. It's set in modern day Appalachia, specifically Virginia, so not too far from where we're recording this. And so I'm just very interested to better appreciate what Kingsolver was doing in her novel, where she's sort of adapting that classic by Dickens. And, you know, also say as a bonus, it's really long. So I figure if I dig into this one, it'll keep me covered in reading for a lot of the summer. It's over 1,000 pages. So, you know, even if I didn't pick any other books this summer, that might cover my summer reading.
And once again, we are overlapping significantly here because, you know, right now I have just started Demon Copperhead, having borrowed your copy of it, and I'm looking forward to doing that. Kingsolver, great writer. I know I first became familiar with her, I think you did too, through the Poisonwood Bible years ago, which, again, we're throwing in other recommendations here, even with our main ones. And I love her. Is it Animal Vegetable Miracle? Is that the name of the book where she...
Nonfiction.
Nonfiction. She and her family sort of go off the grid and, you know, really living from the land for a year at least.
It's a year, yeah.
Yeah, and a very good book. I recommend that one as well. And I will almost certainly read David Copperfield too after Demon Copperhead Dickens. Big influence. I mentioned earlier my path towards being a literature professor. I think it was A Tale of Two Cities. It probably tipped me in that direction way back in ninth grade or so.
Mm. Well, and I'm hoping, I mean, I feel like Demon Copperhead has a lot to say about sort of the roots of social inequities in the U.S. and kind of how those came to be and how they remain to today. And I have the sense that David Copperfield will also look at some of those social, societal, cultural issues that can create such problems. And, you know, I think that that is a place where sometimes fiction can feel a little bit less, you know, pragmatic and practical, but I also do think that sort of the empathy and just the bigger picture thinking about how things come to be, why they come to be, can be, even if they come from a work of fiction, can be applied to the real world and help us understand what's going on around us.
Yeah, I think nonfiction does this too, but I think more so fiction just gives you this sort of thought space to work and play and learn in.
And I will say that the Dickens is essentially a recommendation. We were talking earlier about there's so many books, and so how do you find good ones? It can be going back to authors whose work you already know, either because you read it or you read other works by them. But recommendations are another great way. Obviously, we're making some recommendations for you, dear listener, as we're talking today. But the Dickens was sort of an indirect recommendation, right? Barbara Kingsolver is essentially pointing us all back to David Copperfield when she's basing her own novel on that. So I also think that's another way to look at recommendations. If you find a book or a thinker or an author that you admire, look at who they read or who they are basing their work on, and that can lead to interesting paths to explore. This brings us to our third recommendation each, at least our third main recommendation, and this is the wild card category. And for my wild card, I am picking a collection of poetry called Our Andromeda by Brenda Shaughnessy. And we've talked about recommendations several times already in the podcast. This is a book that was specifically recommended to me by a poet teacher. He was commenting on some of my poems and recommended Shaughnessy's work as a potential example of how I might achieve something in a poem. I know her work a little bit, but not deeply. I sort of know kind of single poems. And so I'm looking forward to digging in and sort of seeing how she puts a full collection together. What I do know of her work is that it's deeply inventive. And I thought I might just share the opening of a poem. It's not from Our Andromeda. This is from one of her other books, but this is a poem called I Have a Time Machine, but unfortunately it can only travel into the future at a rate of 1 second per second, which seems slow to the physicists and to the grant committees, and even to me. And the poem goes on from there, but I think like you get a sense of just her inventiveness, this idea of a time machine, but it can only go into the future at the rate of 1 second per 1 second. And so essentially it's what we're living and it's our life. So she has these wonderful, deeply inventive ways of thinking about the world. And so I look forward to digging into that collection and beginning to kind of deconstruct the poems in the collection and understand a little bit how she put individual poems together and then put them together into this collection.
I like it when books have a kind of an interesting setup like that. Goes back to what I was saying about the guest lecture and that just feeling like an interesting setup to me. Of course, I can all, you know, it can go terribly wrong, but when it goes right, it just is inspiring to see somebody take a concept like that and run with it and just what they're able to do with it. That may also be one that I take a look at, but I'll offer up my own wild card here, which is No One to Meet, Imitation and Originality in the Songs of Bob Dylan. yeah, and this is by Raphael Falco. And I have not read anything by Raphael Falco before, so this will be first venture into that. But folks who know me know that I am something of a an armchair rock historian. I like to read biographies of bands and individual musicians. And Dylan is somebody I've read about before. I've read Dylan before because he is a writer. In addition to being a songwriter, he writes
a Nobel Prize winning writer.
That's right. And he writes poetry. He writes biographical nonfiction type stuff. I have his Philosophy of Modern Song on the bedside table right now, which I've read maybe a quarter of. I have to say, I find it very difficult to read Bob himself when he writes. I'm not a big fan of his narrative voice, even though I'm a big fan of his music. But reading about him is a different matter. So I'm looking forward to this. I mean, he's just obviously such an iconic figure. And the book seems to, it looks like it's sort of positioning him as working in a similar way to how a Renaissance writer might have written, and using this kind of art of imitation to then make it into something completely new. So there's an aspect of innovation in here, to go back to Kim and Mulburn originally. This is, you know, innovation in the more artistic sense. You know, so I want to see sort of how he gets positioned in a bigger cultural tradition that goes way back, you know, into the Renaissance, and then obviously with somebody who's shaped our current culture so much. So I think that's just going to be an interesting aspect of this.
Well, I think it's interesting to me just in that title, the subtitle, Imitation and Originality in the Songs of Bob Dylan. I feel like he gets held up as this paradigm of originality and like such this, you know, amazing kind of new voice. So I like this idea of looking at, you know, what was he imitating? What was he looking to from the past?
Yeah, and I mean, it's pretty well established that, of course, he was drawing on people like, you know, Woody Guthrie and the folk tradition and that sort of thing. But certainly he turned it into something really different. And my understanding, too, is this is more about sort of his later body of work, too, not those, you know, blowing in the wind type stuff that would have been drawing on somebody like Guthrie. So I'm interested to see how that goes. And, you know, in terms of what I'm hoping to learn, it's getting insight into tapping into other traditions, which, again, is what I sort of understand this book to be about. And then, of course, aside from being an amateur or armchair rock philosopher or historian, I am also a singer-songwriter, so I'm hoping I, you know, pick up a tip or two from the maestro there on what I can do with my own songs.
So book reviews, book reports, other kind of after-the-fact reflections on books, I feel like those are pretty common. We get a lot of those in our world and in our culture, but I really like this idea of giving some focus on the front end. You know, how are we selecting books and what questions do we bring to reading a book, or what do we hope that we might get from that read? And it seems like if you bring some of this pre-work to reading, that might deepen the reading experience and the learning that comes from it. Reading, particularly reading guided by active inquiry and genuine curiosity, is a great way to learn. What do you plan to read? We encourage you to give some thought to what you'll read in the weeks ahead, and we'd love to hear what's on your reading list.
At leadinglearning.com/episode362, you'll find show notes, a full transcript, and links to the books we referenced in this episode. And in the comments, you can let us know what's on your reading list.
On the Leading Learning site, you'll also find all kinds of good reading material, from executive briefings to blog posts. There's a search option available on all the pages at the site, so you can use that to locate reading on a topic that interests you, or you can go to leadinglearning.com/executive-briefings to check out our most recent briefings.
We'd be grateful if you'd take a minute to rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, especially if you enjoy the show. So Lisa and I personally appreciate reviews and ratings, and they help the podcast show up when people search for content on leading a learning business.
And please spread the word about Leading Learning. You can do that in a one-on-one note or conversation with a colleague, or you can do it through social media. In the show notes at leadinglearning.com/episode362, you'll find links to connect with us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.